Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for October 20th, 2017. This is Beethoven's Egmont Overture, a pretty common overture on concert programs. But it's only the first 8 or so minutes of a lot of music Beethoven wrote for Goethe's play, Egmont. Tomorrow night, the Boston Symphony will perform this overture, along with the rest of the music from Egmont, and we'll have the performance for you live on the radio beginning at 8 p.m. Egmont is the first half of the program, and the second half is a theatrical adaptation of Peer Gynt with music by Edvard Grieg. Ken David Mazur is the conductor of the program, and you'll hear him talk about it on this podcast. Also on the podcast are two members of the Berlin Philharmonic in conversations with Alan McClellan. Fergus McWilliam plays horn, and he's a member of the Berlin Philharmonic Wind Quintet. And Christian Stadelmann is the leader of the second violin section of the orchestra, and he's also a member of the Philharmonia Quartet Berlin. Both of those ensembles performed concerts presented by the Celebrity Series of Boston last season, and you'll hear them on WCRB in concert this Sunday night at 7 p.m. The production of Peer Gynt the BSO is doing this week was put together by Bill Barclay, who is originally from the Boston area and is now the director of music at Shakespeare's Globe in London. You may remember his name from the adaptation of A Midsummer Night's Dream the BSO did at Tanglewood last summer and at Symphony Hall about a year and a half ago. In that case, he fashioned a show that condensed Shakespeare's play to the parts relevant to Mendelssohn's score for the play. In the case of Peer Gynt, which, as a play, is something like 5 hours long, Barclay wrote an original version of the story based on Ibsen's play. He put it this way in his notes: bonsais aren't cut from whole trees, nor is mini-golf fashioned from the rib of Pebble Beach. To condense this much, I just absorbed all I could, then put the books down, and made something new. I got together with Ken David Mazur, who is the associate conductor of the Boston Symphony, to talk about it after a rehearsal earlier this week. Ken is the son of the late Kurt Mazur, who was the music director of the New York Philharmonic and the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra. And so he grew up backstage, as they say. And that background turned out to be even more relevant than I expected when I asked him if he knew the stories of Egmont and Peer Gynt before taking on this program at the BSO.
I grew up with both of these stories because of course, my father. He did them quite often. In fact, I performed the Greek Peer Gynt incidental music as a chorister in the Gewandhaus Children's Choir, and even recorded it, and then we did it in many different places. And I've also assisted him later on in Paris, in fact, with Camilla Tilling as a soloist. So this is somewhat of a reunion for us, and she's as wonderful as always. But the history of this, the story, I mean, I feel almost as if I've become half Norwegian because the story was told very often. Of course, the whole thing is just, a huge collection of stories, which I didn't read the whole thing, but I know the story. And, there are different versions and translations and even storybooks for kids. And we've gone through many of these stories that Peer has. And Bill Barclay, who created this adaptation and also translation, and just did such an amazing job trying to make sense of the scope of this this thing, which wasn't supposed to be a play in the first place. It was just a collection of these stories of the protagonist Peer Gynt, this folk legend. There's most of Grieg's music, but not all of it, because if you did the whole thing, it would take 4 or 5 hours with the entire play, and so to create a our version of this was quite amazing. But I think it's going to be extraordinary and very, very interesting. There's such depth. There's a lot of humor. There's, of course, you know, with trolls and whatnot and other many, many characters that Peer Gynt, kind of like Gulliver's Travels, that Peer Gynt encounters, there's bound to be a lot of interesting stories to tell, laughs, but then also sort of some tragedy and drama with the relationship that he has with the women in his life. So it's going to be, I think, quite unusual and very, very exciting, different from all the times that I've heard it or I participated in.
And speaking of Bill, did you have much of a hand in collaborating with him in making it, or did Bill sort of go off into his metaphorical composer's hut and kind of put the whole thing together and say, "Okay, Ken, here's what we're doing"?
Well, I think he did, of course, a lot of the writing in terms of he went to the source, and we actually sat down a year ago, and this has been many meetings, many Skype calls and meetings at Tanglewood, even at the end, to kind of go through all of the different details of the script, and him and I going together. I mean, he really went to people and also to me and asked, "So what do you remember about the Peer Gynt as being important to you or striking to you?" And he asked many questions to really delve into the story, into the character, and from the ground up understand what makes this such an extraordinary story, character, and also what the music is about. And what I shared with him in that process early on was, Greek writing a letter, I think, if it was to the director or even the publisher, where he talks about, well, the music that I've written really is there to serve the story, so basically do what you will with it. And, there are things that they changed in terms of instrumentation, even in terms of versions. There are actually several slightly different versions out there anyhow. So I think Bill, understanding the complexity of the story line and getting the audience with you, and experiencing something that really comes to a close, was something important to him. And then with this, I wouldn't call it license, but with this encouragement from Grieg, we went into the music looking at it and creating something truly original that will still tell the whole story, but with the music slightly changed, some of the order slightly changed. And I think it's working out extremely well. So it is... And it is a collaboration. I basically went, with him, talked a lot about the music and about the characters and maybe some what characters to leave out. But ultimately, he did really the big. I mean, the words and everything. The big vision was certainly his.
And the way you describe his getting into it sort of tells us something about Bill's process, that he wanted to hear from other people about what their experience of these stories was, so he could really channel some things that people would value in the storytelling. In that same way, do you feel like these scores, Beethoven's Egmont and Peer Gynt from Grieg, do these particular musical scores tell us something about those two composers that we might not know from any other of the work that they wrote?
Wow. Well, certainly there's, in terms of Beethoven, maybe not something that the other pieces don't tell you about Beethoven, because Egmont is, of course, a character and a person and a protagonist that Beethoven actually identified with, and I think he would have otherwise not written just any kind of incidental music. But because of the story of Egmont believing in sort of the goodness, the goodwill of people, and then becoming a martyr for hope, basically, and for that to live on, is something that he, I think, identified with, because there's a certain loneliness when you feel... in all of the works of Beethoven, that he is fighting against this by himself. He's alone in fighting for something that people cynically look down on. You know, him thinking that there's good in the world and virtue in the world, and that, you know, even people who shun him or who have who've been very divisive in the way they've treated him, that he is hoping for a better world, and that is even nowadays, you know, kind of looked down upon. So I think that Beethoven, through the incidental music of Egmont, is telling us a lot. Just in the music alone, we are not. I mean, what we're performing is really just the complete incidental music by Beethoven, without the entire, of course, monologue or dialogue that could happen, because we simply don't have that. We need two evenings, separate evenings for that. But it will tell you. It has hints of the emotions that Egmont is going through, and also in the very end, what it means to be victorious through hope. And Beethoven is telling us a consistent story in that. So it's nothing new, but he just reiterates that. Of course, in terms of the music, Egmont, the overture is played, which is, of course, an incredible powerhouse overture and reveals so much. But to hear all of this all together, you know, especially together with Camilla, who plays the role of Klärchen, and then later Solveig, you know, there are these two characters that have something in common. There's sort of an innocence and sort of a very loving, a great loving, patient, and very loyal character, as opposed to the rest of the world. So there we have, you know, one of the many connections between Grieg's incidental music and Beethoven.
And thematically, these two together are so interesting because, as you say, the self-sacrifice on the part of Egmont on a same evening with the sort of self-fulfillment, I'll put it gently, of Per, he's really kind of out for himself. And so both of these themes feel like, you know, wow, we can look around us today and just see all that. All that is around us today in whatever event or venue you want to talk about. Does that relevance to today sort of inform you in any way as you're preparing or performing the two works?
Well, it's absolutely true that you have two different characters, Egmont and Per, who deal in their own ways with the reality of a world that has a lot of wrong things going on, and that you can be tempted to go the wrong direction. And so we have, that's right, we have the two very contrasting, in terms of the spectrum, you know, they're both at different ends. And I think with Per, there's something very, of course, you know, now there are people who just feel, oh, there's no hope, so I better make the best of what I get. You know, I have my youth, and, you know, women seem to like me, or, you know, they can be foolish. And certainly that, you know, we talk about, and Bill, who, you know, even as he's been rehearsing over a week already with the actors and putting things together, and you know, they change things here and there depending on what's happening in the news, and to make it truly relevant of what it means to have a character who is not just a story of Norway 200 years ago, but who is somebody who is living amongst us. You know, there are people like Per, many of them will be in the concert. In fact, so that they understand, hey, this is you. And, you know, you're not excluded. This is you. And some people may think, you know, I'm Egmont. I don't know. But I think the bandwidth of the personality and of character traits of the entire evening certainly is something that is reflected in our current day and age, and we think it's very relevant. And certainly we hope that people will take that away as a message of hope, and you know, even with Per, who's straying from a path, he realizes, you know, realization comes in different forms and at different times, and there are two great examples in this program.
It's dynamite program. It's one I've been looking forward to ever since the season was announced. I was thinking, oh boy, that's going to be a great week. So Ken David Mazur, thanks for taking some time to talk about it.
Pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
Ken David Mazur leads the Boston Symphony Orchestra in Beethoven's music for Goethe's Egmont and Grieg's music for Peer Gynt, both, by the way, featuring soprano Camilla Tilling and narrator and actor Will Lyman. And the Grieg also features several other actors, as well as the Tanglewood Festival Chorus. Should be a really fun show, and you can hear it live on the radio on Saturday night beginning at 8 p.m. And we'll also rebroadcast the concert on Monday, October 30th at 8 p.m. This Sunday at 7, Alan McClellan brings you WCRB in concert with the Celebrity Series of Boston, featuring two of the chamber ensembles of the Berlin Philharmonic. Alan spent a little time with members of both ensembles, and beyond previewing the music, he asked them about the Berlin Phil's structure as a player-run organization and about the orchestra's incoming music director, Kirill Petrenko. Here's the first of these two conversations. Alan asked violinist Christian Stadelmann of Philharmonia Quartet Berlin about the role of chamber music in the life of the Berlin Philharmonic.
We are in a very lucky and happy situation because, of course, we play with all our emotion and we love to play in the orchestra, of course. But we have time enough to form chamber music ensembles, and we are playing string quartet now for over 30 years and with a real considerable number of concerts every year. And I think this is great for us to just to have a look over the normal horizon of an orchestra musician, and also very good for the orchestra itself, because you it's like toothbrushing, teeth cleaning. As a string player, you play in the big group. Even as section leader, you have to fit into the sound of everybody, unless you have a solo. And in chamber music, you play for yourself, not as a soloist, but in a small group, and you hear yourself, and it's very good to have the control over what you are really doing, how you are forming your sound, how is the articulation, how is intonation. And it's, I think, every good orchestra should give opportunities to their members to make chamber music.
Because yeah. You spend so much time blending in with the section,
yes,
in the orchestra.
Yes, it's an absolutely, it's a different approach, and you have to, you play different roles. In the orchestra, it's more about blending. You need initiative as well. You can't play passive. That's not the style of Berlin Philharmonic. But your activity must be integrated in the whole thing. Otherwise, people would stick out of the sound, and that's not good at all. And for chamber music, you can also have your own ideas. You can try whatever tempo you want and not what the conductor wants. So it's, although it's more or less the same music we play, the same composers, it's a different approach, and it's great for a musician to have both worlds. Yeah.
How does it work then practically? Because you must have to spend quite a bit of time rehearsing chamber music.
Yeah, of course. And it's a question of planning. Yeah, we know the schedule of the orchestra about 2 years in advance normally. And so we can find the places where is room for chamber music, where do I have my colleague, if I can be free for that week, and so on.
So it's just a matter of coordination, but there is a desire on the part of the administration to make.
Yes, and they leave us this kind of freedom, and that's really good for us.
I'm learning that the Berlin Philharmonic is a self-governing organization in many ways, so that often the administration is being done by players themselves.
Yeah,
that probably contributes, does it, to the sense of the value of chamber music making?
I don't think so. I think there's the self-government, so-called self-government of the orchestra. It's really about orchestra things, and making chamber music is our private initiative. And in the beginning, we tried even to get not too much that the audience should not see us as orchestra musicians who just play quartet, but more as individuals and as a chamber music ensemble, and not too many connections. And to be honest, in interviews like this, I hated always questions about Karajan and how was the time and everything like that.
All right, well, I want to ask that.
Just a warning for you.
I actually did want to come and ask you about the new conductor, and are you excited about that?
I am very excited about that because Mr. Petrenko, for me, is more or less a blank sheet of paper. I played only once with him. This was a fantastic experience. But, we will see. So this was a very, how can I say, mutig, courageous or what, decision. He makes himself very rare. So he conducted our orchestra only 3 times, and 2 times of this I was away with chamber music.
Wow.
You see? And so I was somehow astonished myself that we chose Mr. Petrenko, but I'm very happy about it, really.
And is it his specific approach to music making that is the key thing that makes you happy?
Yes, absolutely. And he is famous for doing extreme detailed he won't forgive any mistake, and he uses every minute of his time. And the first reaction after the orchestra elected him, oh, the orchestra will hate me because I rehearse so much. So, but we hope he do.
Yes, that's great. So your ensemble, the Philharmonia Quartet, has been going since 1985 with almost the same members.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the secret to the longevity?
You have to find yourself together, and the chemistry must be somehow right. I can't explain that better. Just in the beginning of our ensemble, there were some changes until the right people found themselves. And this was about 1 year or so. And then I was the last one who joined the formation. And then there was only one change when our former cellist died. And we were very lucky to find a new friend and colleague. But in the whole thing, we stayed together as a quartet since more than 30 years now. Yeah.
Wow. Can I embarrass you and ask you about your colleagues?
Sure.
And the kind of... I was thinking about the character that is required by this music. Beethoven particularly requires characters. And I was wondering if you could comment on the characters you have within your group and how they contribute. So Daniel Stavrava
is the first violinist, and he's concertmaster in the orchestra, and he's a fantastic violin player. And in his case, we are very happy that his skills don't let him to take a career as a soloist or something he could easily do, but he spends the time with chamber music and with us, and maybe he loses a bit of being more famous, but he's absolutely delighted by the quality of this music. Often composers did their best for string quartets, and he's eager to know this music and to play it. And so we are very happy to have a really gifted violinist and a talented one who spends his time with us and not as a soloist on stage.
Yes, he does do solos with the Brilliant Philharmonic.
Yes, he is doing his solo things as well, but not that much. Otherwise, there would be no time for playing quartet.
Yeah. Right. Amazing. Yeah. And you have Neidhardt Reza, the violist.
Yeah. He was the principal viola player for many, many years. He was sitting in the group recently, just because he's retired now, more or less. He's 66, and in Germany we have this rigid law, playing up to 65 or 66, in the future will be 67. And so his life as an orchestra musician goes slowly to an end. But
what will happen then for your quartet, I mean?
That doesn't affect the quartet. We can do whatever we want because it's really private. But for this, for every colleague, it's a big cut, of course. If you play to the last day with full energy and from next day on, you are retired. That's different in America, I know, yeah.
Yes.
Both systems have advantages and disadvantages, yeah. Won't.
That's right.
Won't go to the details.
It goes around. That's a long conversation, yeah. Isn't it? And then Dietmar Schwalke is your newest player.
Yes, he came for Jan Dieselhorst, who died very suddenly on a heart problem. And I knew Dietmar longer than everybody else because we met already in Berlin while we studied, and we played together in my former school. He was also connected to those people. So for me, it was like coming home with an old friend.
Oh, that's so nice. Yeah. And self-analysis, what's your role? What's your personality?
Yeah, I am a second violinist with my whole heart. I play the second violin in the orchestra as well. I'm section leader there. And I've always been playing the second violin in the quartet, which is nice. I love this job and this the special things you need to know and to deal with, because sometimes you have the sort of melody or the activity, but most of the time it's in the first violin, and you have to switch between two roles. If the first violin leads the whole thing, you have to accompany, of course, but to have you are gluing the ensemble together, because I am sitting closest to the principal violin, and yeah, this is the one role. And suddenly you have to switch and be soloist, maybe for one bar, for half a bar. And this very quick changing of behavior and roles is what makes second violin for me interesting and a challenge. But to be honest, from time to time I play sonatas, we play piano trio as well, where it's only one first violin. And I need that for me as well to train my skills on the higher E string and so on.
there's an awful lot of work to being second violin. The quartet often gets complimented for the richness of its sound as an ensemble. So the smoothness of it. And I guess the orchestra itself gets complimented for that, as opposed to some other string quartets that have spiky.
Yeah, I know what
sounds.
You mean. Yeah. It's always a question, or it's the character of German music ensembles. If you pronounce more the individuality of each player, or if you strive to have more this feeling of one melody out of four instruments. And it should not be 100% one or the other. But you are right. Our focus is maybe more on the blend of sound, of really sounding together and not fighting too much against each other as individuals. That's our characteristic, I would say. Yeah, I would agree.
I mean, it just makes for a wonderful kind of experience as a listener to hear this blend. This is only four instruments, and yet it sounds so unified. And I wanted to ask you about the program itself.
Yeah.
You have Haydn, Beethoven, mm-hmm. and Schumann.
Very traditional.
Very traditional. The Opus 64 quartets are Haydn at his maturity, I guess.
Yeah.
And what's special about this particular Opus 64? It's the number four.
Yeah. I have to admit, for me, every Haydn quartet is very special. He invented this
genre or something?
This genre, yeah. And it's amazing how many different styles he already composed. Once we did a whole concert only with Haydn quartets, starting with very early ones, Opus 9, and then going on to the 70s. And it was not boring for 1 second because they are all so different. And it's hard for me to say that this special Haydn is better than another one. I love them all. It's a real masterpiece. Of course, 64, he was not young anymore. And he was a real master composing this. Maybe what makes it a little bit special is the combination with the second piece, with Opus 18, number 6 by Beethoven, because this is a very serioso style work. It's the last movement has this title La Malinconia, and it's very sad, and it's very much about your inner feelings. And the Haydn, on the contrary, is very optimistic, joyful, and making jokes with the music. So this kind of contrast between composers who lived so close to each other should be the main interest for the first half of the concert.
Yeah, and Beethoven taking what Haydn had passed along to him and kind of going further with it.
Absolutely, yeah.
There's contrasts, too, in Beethoven, inside the Beethoven quartet.
Sure, this is a whole cosmos, and the late ones, we play just the cycle of the late Beethoven quartets combined with late Shostakovich in Berlin. This is completely different speech of music. It's hard to describe. But the Opus 18, number 6, is the last one of the beginning cycle. And for me, it somehow leads already into this middle and later section of the Beethoven quartets. Yeah. For instance, the form of the last movement, this Malinconia, is so interrupted. It's not like a normal last movement, presto and joyful and everything like that. it's a sad beginning and then positive second part and going back to the sad beginning and so on. And in the end, the positive mood will come over the melancholy. That's
prevail.
Nice.
Yes, that's wonderful. Yeah. So and then Schumann is kind of this wonderful looking forward to later Romanticism.
Yeah,
but it has elements of Haydn and Beethoven and Mozart as well.
And it has elements of melancholy as well, because Schumann was, you know, that a very divided person. He had moments in his life where he was full of joy, enthusiastic, and other moments where he was really melancholic, depressive. And in this quartet, you can hear somehow both of these parts from him. The slow movement is so deep. And on the contrary, we have also very fast movement, the scherzoso, like scherzoso, and optimistic elements. So this is, in itself, it shows very, very much changes of character.
Mm. And this just kind of came to me, but I was wondering if you have occasion sometimes to need to introduce a person to string quartet music who has never heard it before. And if you did, what would you say to them? What would you say? Come and listen for this.
We do many things to introduce people to our music. Sometimes it's just that we play for them and they are new, so we can't do anything with words. But sometimes presenters ask us to talk about the pieces, what we are doing, and play little excerpts and explain how the composer's working. And on the other hand, we are also giving master classes where we talk to young students who already know all this kind of music but can know more about this and learn things about. So for a person who never heard a string quartet before, I can't give any advice. I would just say forget all vorurteile, prejudice. That's it. Forget everything about that chamber music and especially string quartet is for an educated audience. It is, but don't tell those people. And you can really enjoy, also with ears that are not used to it, the richness and the blend of sound and hear four people speaking, sometimes together, sometimes not. And my advice would only be open and stay, be honest with your own feelings. Even if you say, I don't like it, you have at least you had an impression and it was not boring. And that's what I can say. But obviously it's true. If you learn, the more you learn about German music and the more you hear, you can estimate what great treasures we have for this genre, string quartet. Mm.
It's a yes, it's a wonderful thing, and I and you as a participant, can you say what you get out of it, just as an individual?
Sure, I feel I have different feelings with different pieces. For instance, when we play the cavatina of Beethoven of the last, not the last one, but very late 130, I always thought this is like prayer, and there are parts in it where the soul of man is anxious, and then the prayer leads himself or itself back to confidentiality. This kind of music I feel very strong, and it's one of my favorite pieces. And there are others which lead into different moods. For instance, if you play the Haydn, and you were in bad mood before because you were angry about anything, after the rehearsal with Haydn, you look positive into the world. And so each piece has some different effect on you. And that's exactly what I love in doing chamber music, that your feelings can move and you have you can direct them to different things. And it's not the same all day. Yeah.
Christian Stadelmann, thank you so much for your time today, and have a wonderful concert.
Thanks a lot.
Christian Stadelmann is one of the violinists of Philharmonia Quartet Berlin, and you can hear them on WCRB in concert with the Celebrity Series of Boston on Sunday night beginning at 7 p.m. On the same broadcast is the Berlin Philharmonic Wind Quintet, and their horn player, Fergus McWilliam, met Alan at a restaurant in the Back Bay when the quintet visited Boston last year. Here's Alan.
Tell me about the Wind Quintet itself and what motivated the Berlin Philharmonic to put together these chamber ensembles, and specifically this one.
Well, I have to go back a bit on that. To describe our institutional interest in chamber music, the orchestra as an institution is very, very supportive of all chamber music activities. But when I say that, I have to point out, remember, we are a self-run orchestra. It's not an employee status in a sense. It's something that we encourage all our fellow colleagues to do. It keeps our skills sharp, and enhances and deepens the philosophy of the orchestra, which is that we see ourselves as a chamber orchestra or a chamber ensemble of large proportion. So in that now something like 35 or more separate chamber ensembles are active among the ranks of the orchestra, this is how we keep ourselves informed, as it were. So we're actually supported when we take a long trip like this, a three-week tour of the United States. We have no institutional opposition. In fact, we are quite supported in this.
So does the orchestra consider that it's a benefit to the orchestra playing to actually have people playing chamber music?
Yes, exactly. The chamber music skills which we practice, we take back with us to the large orchestra, and then informs the sound of the orchestra. The initiative for ensembles, though, is individual. There's no institutional umbrella hanging over it, other than asking for permission to use the name.
At what point did you get involved yourself?
Well, Walter Seifert, our clarinetist, is the one who was guilty. He first approached the other four of us, the original four. Henning Torg was our first bassoonist, back in 1988, to join him for a one-off coffeehouse concert. The idea was we'd get free beer if we went around after one of our philharmonic concerts just for a half hour and just jammed a little bit. And the chemistry was obviously apparent right there. Up until that point, we had not known each other. We sat near each other in the orchestra. We played together, but we didn't know each other yet. And through this one-off, very spontaneous and unprepared concert, we discovered we got along very well, but we also noticed there was musical chemistry happening, as did the audience, and there was a very high demand for us to return to the same coffee house a month later and do a full program, which was more than sold out. People were having to stand outside and all over the aisles. And we realized we might have something. And so we started in 1988. We've been going now for, do the math, it'll be 29 years this year.
So was the wind quintet the first chamber ensemble, or were there others? Because there, since then, there's the string quartet and there's a wind ensemble. Can you talk about how it expanded?
Well, we are still cohesive and unique and separate from all the other possibilities. I mean, our quintet also takes part as the core of the wind, we call it the winds of the Berlin Philharmonic. That's basically an octet expanded to 13 players for Mozart's Gran Partita. That ensemble had kind of gone to sleep for many, many years, and so we decided to reactivate it around our own quintet by inviting friends to join us. But most of the ensembles that are on the boards today are more recent creations. We belong to one of those traditional ensembles with a history now approaching 30 years. There aren't many. I believe the Philharmonia Quartet, a string quartet, and the Sharoun Ensemble, and maybe the Philharmonic Octet, which appears sporadically, have a history that goes back a little bit further. The octet itself goes back to the 1920s. That's the first recorded concert of that particular formation, but very sporadically. In the more recent history, which roughly parallels the end of the Karajan era, roughly 1980 and onwards, the Philharmonia Quartet, the Sharoun Ensemble, and our wind quintet are the three who have worked continually and consistently since then, each of us, you know, in the 30-year range.
I would like to talk to you about the program itself. First of all, do you start with Mozart?
Mm-hmm. We start with the Andante, or excuse me, this piece in F minor that was written for a mechanical organ. It's one of three works that remain, that survived in Mozart's oeuvre. He would do anything for money, you know. And these were written for an instrument that no longer exists. They only in museums, they're unplayable. But they were mechanical, something like a hurdy-gurdy or driven by a cylinder. And they would play an organ in all kinds of sizes. And three of the three surviving works of Mozart include the last one, K616, is for a tiny little thing that sat on a table, and he hated the sound of it. And the other one that we're doing here, 594, can be played on a large church organ. It's a huge instrument. So there are many transcriptions for piano and for organ, but not for wind instruments. And we thought, this is one time we would permit ourselves to do an arrangement, because we don't generally like to do that. And our flutist, Michael Hassel, is the one responsible for this arrangement. Very, very effective. This is then followed right away by the Kalevi Aho second quintet. Big work. We commissioned this with the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra together with him to get this new work, which we premiered a couple of just 1 year ago and recorded earlier, just last October we recorded it, to partner with his first quintet, which we had already recorded. We don't take any credit for the existence of the first quintet. That was a Finnish group who played it once and put it away again, saying it was unplayable. Well, that sort of grabbed our attention. And our record company, BIS, the Swedish record company, was very keen on having us perform and record the Aho for their complete recording of all his works. And so we were shown the score, and we were just fascinated by it. So we made the effort, and we got number one done. Once we'd tasted blood, we said, we could have more of this. So we commissioned the second one. And that's the work we're performing tonight at Jordan Hall.
So what makes Aho unique and interesting?
Silly answer, he's Finnish. Just like Sibelius before him. When Sibelius was first heard, people did not know what to make of his musical language. It wasn't avant-garde, it wasn't off-putting, but it was unusual. It was a new language that no one had ever heard, and frankly, never since. And similarly, in my opinion, Aho's language is unique in the same way. Must have something to do with the Finnish language. I'm not sure why or how. But it's fascinating. He's a wonderful and interesting guy who writes his music on paper with a pencil, straight out of his head. It's almost like watching, if you can imagine, Mozart writing down his works as if they're complete. And yet they have incredibly intricate and complex rhythms. I think the audience is going to be very surprised, because it's not off-putting music. It's not hard to listen to. But it's something you'll never have heard before, these combinations, these sounds, the range of only out of only five instruments. He gets something the size of an orchestra. It's an immense emotional and a sonic journey. The second half begins with Ligeti, his very popular Six Bagatelles, which is always a crowd pleaser, despite the name Ligeti. You know.
Well, we think of 2001, A Space Odyssey, a bit generally.
Okay, atmosphere for the big orchestra. But some of his other music, people are a little bit off-put by the names. Oh, this is the modern music I have to listen to along, you know, the medicine I have to take along with the rest of the concert. It's going to be quite different. This is quite folksy music. And it comes from a period in the 1950s when he was being banned already in Hungary. He couldn't get his music performed. And so this is a very wonderful thing, and it's really fun to listen to. And then we close with the other big work, which is the Nielsen Quintet. Carl Nielsen, the Danish composer, who has written virtually a symphony for wind quintet. And like Aho in the first half, with only five instruments on stage, you get an extraordinarily large tonal palette, a huge spectrum of sounds.
Fergus McWilliam is the horn player of the Berlin Philharmonic Wind Quintet, and you can hear them on Sunday night at 7 p.m. on WCRB in concert with the Celebrity Series of Boston. And check out our website on Monday to hear the broadcast on demand. That's at classicalwcrb.org, where you can also find a link to the schedule of upcoming Celebrity Series concerts and performances. You can subscribe to The Answered Question at Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. TAQ is also on SoundCloud and at that website, classicalwcrb.org. Thank you to Ken David Mazur, Christian Stadelmann, and Fergus McWilliam, and the staffs of the BSO and the Celebrity Series, and my colleague, Alan McClellan. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.